he appealed to Titus to allow the city's inhabitants to observe the Sabbath before they surrendered. And Titus' troops graciously withdrew to another city some miles away, and John and his men took that opportunity to flee the city, taking their wives and children with them. He persuaded his men to abandon their wives and children in the darkness because they weren't able to move fast enough, and he was afraid that the Romans would overtake them. And he promised that if they were killed, their families were killed, and they would avenge their deaths on the Romans. And that tells you something about the zealot's mindset. The next morning, when Titus came with his troops, the citizens opened the gates and they explained John's flight. And they begged to be spared. Titus sent his troops after John and the zealots, but it was too late. They had already made it to Jerusalem. But he did find the wives and children, and he massacred 6,000 women and children and returned with 3,000. And then he entered that particular city as a liberator. John, in Jerusalem, when he arrived in Jerusalem, he told the populace of Jerusalem that he had come to help fortify the city. He didn't tell about that they had fled from another place. The older men in Jerusalem perceived, or many of them did, that he was lying. But they were afraid to speak out against such a large force. Quarreling and fighting broke out in Jerusalem. Additional bands of robbers and looters from the countryside sought refuge in the city. They targeted the most prominent men for assassination. They imprisoned them, accused them of being traitors, and then sent persons in to murder them in their prison cells. And then they had a vote, a mock vote, and they selected one of their own to be the high priest. And they dressed him up in the high priest robes, and they told him what to say, and so forth. And so it became quite a mockery. Finally, the citizens of Jerusalem organized enough resistance, and they forced these men to take refuge in the inner court of the temple. John, who was on the outside, and these people that had come in, pretended to side with the people, but in fact, he incited those trapped rebels to resist by reminding them of how many of their countrymen they had already slain outside the city and inside the city. Plus, he said that the population of Jerusalem had sent for the Roman general Vespasian to come and to take the city, which was a lie at that point. But they then, these trapped zealots, appealed to the Idumeans for help. And the Idumeans always were glad for an excuse to invade the Jewish homeland, so they accepted the invitation. They came in, and interesting story, the Jews wouldn't allow them to come in. They shut the city gates, but there was a violent rainstorm that night, and everybody in Jerusalem thought that they would be safe, and so they let their guard down, and these Idumeans cut through the city wall, the city gates, and gained entrance into the city. They without mercy, slaughtered 8,500 people in the temple area. You say that real fast and you don't really get the impression, but 8,500 people. They determined to kill every person that they deemed to be an enemy. And the ones that they deemed to be an enemy was anybody who disagreed with them, anybody who avoided contact with them, and anybody who seemed to be really friendly with them was killed. They threw the bodies outside the walls and refused to allow anyone to retrieve them for burial. The Roman generals, upon learning about this, perceived this civil war to be in their favor, and so they appealed to Vespasian to quickly come and to take Jerusalem while the population was divided before they had a chance to reunite. And Vespasian responded with these words, "God acts as general of the Romans better than I do." They were careful not to use their weapons against each other, but rather engaged in a contest to see who could acquire the most loot. Their leader became Eleazar, the son of Simon. They made the temple itself, temple proper, their headquarters. And not far from Jerusalem was a fortress which had been fortified by Jewish kings as a refuge in case of war, as well as a repository for arms, and it was called Masada. A radical group called the Sicarii had, by deception, gained control of this stronghold. When they realized that Rome was not advancing on Jerusalem, but Vespasian was still patiently taking his time, taking one city after another in his march, then they left their stronghold and began looting neighboring cities, ravaging and killing all the inhabitants. Bands of robbers from all over Judea followed their example and then retreated to Masada. Vespasian continued to methodically capture every city in the region, refusing to go directly to Jerusalem, but determined not to leave any resistance at his back when he finally did besiege Jerusalem, because he knew that it was going to be the most difficult of all the cities to take. Meanwhile, back in Rome, as Vespasian prepares to besiege Jerusalem, word comes that Nero is dead, and Galba has returned from Spain and was crowned as emperor of Rome. And so Vespasian retires to Caesarea, which would be the place where the Roman generals lived in that part of the world, to await word from Galba. Galba was assassinated in the marketplace after only 7 months and 7 days. Otho was made emperor, and Vespasian awaited news as to whether or not his forces were needed in Rome. Meanwhile, back in Masada, the Sicarii forces have now swollen to 40,000, led by Simon of Gerasa. The Jerusalem zealots didn't want to engage Simon's forces in battle, but they did manage to kidnap his wife. And this so enraged Simon that he captured everyone who came outside the city of Jerusalem. He tortured them to death. He cut off their hands. And he delivered all the hands into the city, and he told them that if they did not release his wife unharmed, he would do that to every single inhabitant of Jerusalem. They released his wife. Now, civil war rages back in Rome. Otho was emperor. His forces killing those who were inclined toward peace with the Romans and killing anyone who tried to escape the city. The people prayed for the Romans to come and relieve them of the conditions inside the city. As the Sabbath approached, Eleazar, whose forces are holed up in the temple, makes a fateful decision. He decides to allow worshipers to come and to enter the temple to observe the Passover. Some of John's forces disguise themselves and gain admittance, concealing their weapons. When they pull their weapons out and start killing the worshipers, then Eleazar's troops flee to the underground caverns below the temple. And so John has now taken as well as the temple grounds and the courtyards, he has now taken the inner temple and he has dissolved Eleazar's forces. So the three factions have now become two. The Romans now surround the city, or at least the vulnerable portions of the city. One portion of the city has an extremely high cliff, and so that's kind of off limits as far as them being able to scale that. But they surround the vulnerable portions of the city 7 soldiers deep. John and his forces, the number 8,400, hold the temple and the temple area. Simon and his forces, which now number 15,000, control the upper and lower city. The Romans now begin their siege. They begin to raise ramps against the outer wall. There are 3 walls around Jerusalem. And they raise ramps against the outer wall to gain height for their catapults. Catapults that the Romans have are capable of hurling a 75-pound stone 1,000 feet. The zealots could not reach these catapults because of their height. They could not turn them over because of their weight, and they couldn't burn them because they were covered with plates of iron. The zealots decide that they have to retreat from the wall, and so the Romans enter the lower city, and they camp there, now having gained access into the very outer part of the city. 5 days later, the Romans make a small breach in the second wall, and they decide, and I'm leaving out things that I just really hate to leave out, but they decide to only make a small breach in the wall because they think surely now these Jews will capitulate. And so Titus sends in a relatively small force of only 1,000 men to go into the city to try to get them, to persuade them to capitulate. He does not take any prisoners when the soldiers go in. They don't set anything on fire. They make a request to the leaders of the people that the people who want to, who desire to, be allowed to leave the city. And that if the zealots desire to keep on fighting, that they do so without inflicting further harm on the people. And they also remove themselves from the temple because he doesn't want to destroy the temple. Well, the zealots, of course, take this as a sign of weakness. family appeared to be healthy, or if they kept their doors locked, the zealots broke the doors down. They searched for food, often torturing family members to make them tell where food was hidden. They ignored those that were dying from hunger. Some citizens ventured out at night to try to gather some food, but when they got outside the city, they were afraid not to return because the zealots knew that they were outside the city. If they didn't return, they would kill their families. If the Romans captured them, they were afraid of that. They were afraid that they would be tortured, and so they fought when they captured them outside the city. And this, of course, enraged the Roman soldiers. The Romans captured an average of 500 a day who were out trying to scavenge for food. Titus decided to try to create fear in the people in Jerusalem by crucifying all these prisoners before the wall. So he did. Several thousand of them were crucified. And when the people looked out and saw all these people hanging on crosses, the zealots reminded the population that this is exactly what they told them was going to happen if they tried to escape. And so Titus stopped. He quit executing the people. Titus personally pleads with the inhabitants to surrender and preserve their city and their temples. And the zealots respond that God resides in the temple and he will not allow Gentiles to take that temple. Now, whether they believe this at that point or not, or whether they're just using that to manipulate the people, I really don't know. Titus devised a new tactic. He builds a wall around the city to prevent anyone from escaping. And his troops built that wall in 3 days. A wall that took months and months to rebuild early. Josephus will describe the famine. Quote, "So all hope of escaping was now cut off from the Jews, together with their liberty of going out of the city. Then did the famine widen its progress and devour the people by whole houses and families. The upper rooms were full of women and children that were dying by the famine. And the lanes of the city were full of dead bodies of all ages. The children also, young men, wandered about in the marketplaces like shadows. All swelled with famine. They fell down dead wherever the misery had seized them. As for burying them, those that were sick themselves were not able to do it. Those that were hardy and well were deterred from doing it by the great multitude of the dead bodies and by the uncertainty there was of how soon they themselves should die. For many died as they were burying others, nor was there any lamentation made over these calamities, nor were heard any mournful complaints, but the famine confounded all natural passions. For those who were just going to die looked upon those that had gone to their rest before them with dry eyes and open mouth. A deep silence and a kind of deadly night had seized upon the city." Two groups of zealots now continued their pillaging. Finding dead and dying persons in the houses, they proved to each other their courage by killing those who begged for mercy and refusing to kill those who begged to die. When Titus viewed the staggering heaps of dead bodies that had been thrown over the wall, he groaned, spread out his hands to heaven, calling God as witness that this was not his doing. John's troops now resort to plundering the temple. They melted down many of the sacred artifacts and vessels. And John's reasoning was, those who fight for the temple should live of the temple. A defector is said to have come to Titus reporting that he had been assigned to a gate in the city to count the bodies that were removed through that one particular gate. He reported that through that one gate, no fewer than 115,880 bodies had been carried. finally one incident which forces him to realize that the zealots are never going to surrender. A certain wealthy woman from Perea had fled to Jerusalem from the encroaching Roman army. The zealots had robbed her of her wealth and all the food that she had stored. They continued coming to her house, sometimes as often as 2 or 3 times per day, demanding food long after her food had run out. She finally lost her mind and went mad from hunger. She killed and roasted her infant child. She ate half the body and hid the remainder. When the zealots smelled the cooking food, they broke into her house and threatened to cut her throat unless she showed them the food that she had cooked. She replied that she had saved a very fine portion of it for them and uncovered what was left of her son. They were seized with horror and amazement. Stood astonished at the sight. When she said to them, "This is my own son, and what hath been done was my own doing. Come and eat of this food, for I have eaten of it myself. Do not pretend to be either more tender than a woman or more compassionate than a mother. But if you are so scrupulous and do abominate this my sacrifice, as I have eaten one half, let the rest be reserved for me also." After which these men went out trembling, being never so much afraid of anything in their life as they were at this. So those that were distressed by the famine were very desirous to die, and those already dead were esteemed happy, because they had not lived long enough either to hear or see such miseries. Titus orders the burning of the temple gates, and to enable his troops to gain access. These gates were so large it took 6 men to open. And after they set it on fire and allowed it to burn for one day, he sent his troops to extinguish the flame. And when his troops approached, the Jews forced them to abandon their efforts to put out the fire. And in a rage against Titus's order, one of his soldiers throws some of the burning material into one of the temple chambers. Titus orders his soldiers to go in and extinguish the fire, but they ignore his orders at this point and shout encouragement at the fire spreading. Unable to stop the flames, Titus enters the holy place to view the splendor of the temple before it's destroyed. His soldiers are slaughtering the zealots. The slain are everywhere. Bodies are heaped around the altar. Blood runs down the steps in the temple. The Holy of Holies bursts into flame. Titus retires with his legions to watch the temple burn. Then there's the mop-up campaign. The Roman legions enter the lower city, burning, looting, and killing. Thousands are slain without regards to age or importance, whether they resisted or begged for their lives. Josephus says, "The ground did nowhere appear visible for the dead bodies that lay on it. But the soldiers went over the top of the heaps of bodies as they ran upon all who fled from them." The Romans ultimately grew tired of killing and began to take prisoners to be sold as slaves. And there were so many that they just released 40,000 and told them to get out of here. Then began the task of taking the upper city where most of the zealots had fled. They burned every house, killed every person that they found alive. Josephus says the whole city ran with blood to such a degree that the fires of many of the houses was quenched with men's blood. Of the young men, he selected the tallest and most handsome to be displayed in the trial. Those above 17 years of age were put into bonds and sent to Egyptian mines. Those that were under 17 were sold as slaves. He also sent a great number into the provinces as a present to them to be used in the game, be killed by sword or by wild beasts. The walls 464 years apart, exactly the same day it was set on fire. I didn't have time in this to tell of the siege that was lifted. Titus was called back to Rome during all this. I just really compacted it down, condensed it down. And when that siege was lifted for a short period of time, the Jews proclaimed that they had defeated the Romans, and all the zealots proclaimed victory. Matthew chapter 24, you remember we read it last week. Jesus said, when that time comes, let him that's on the housetop not come down and gather his possessions, but let him flee to the hills. Pray that your flight won't be in the winter. Woe be to the women who are with child at that time. And so every person who was a Christian who listened to what Jesus had to say when that siege was lifted got out of Dodge. So if they were faithful Christians who listened to the Lord, they didn't die in Jerusalem. And they were spared. No two stones were left on each other in the temple building. I've tried to find out for sure why. I've heard most of my life that the reason was that when they built the temple and the buildings around the temple, that in the mortar they put gold in the mortar. And so the Romans pulled down those blocks, some of which weighed as much as 100 tons. They pulled them down so that they could melt it down and get the gold out of it. I could not verify if that's true or not. I found two or three places where people stated it, but I couldn't find any historical evidence if that's true or if it's not true. So I can't tell you if that's true. But no two stones of the temple or its surrounding buildings were left one on another. The genealogical records were destroyed, and since that time there's not been a single person alive that could truly prove that he's a Jew. Consequences of the destruction of the temple were great. And then, I have 2 or 3 minutes. Let me finish with the last mop-up in Masada. Following the destruction of Jerusalem, there remained but one Jewish stronghold which had not been surrendered or conquered by the Romans. That was Masada. Masada was an impregnable natural fortress in the land of Edom. It had been used by Herod as a fortification against possible Jewish rebellion, as well as a repository for arms, as well as the possibility of Mark Antony deciding to grant Cleopatra's expressed desire that she be given the region of Judea. And so he wanted a place where he could go, an impregnable fortress. This red rock plateau rose several hundred feet above the surrounding plain. It was surrounded by sheer cliffs several hundred feet high. There are only two possible entrances to this fortress. One from the east was practically impossible to ascend. The one from the west, known as the Serpent, because of its winding back upon itself in so many places, could be traversed only in single file. And so, one single man could hold off an entire army. At this time, it contained an abundance of food to last its inhabitants for several years, as well as numerous water pits containing vast quantities of water. There was large quantity of all sorts of weapons of war, sufficient for 10,000 men. The vast amounts of fruits and dates had been stockpiled by Herod almost 100 years early and were perfectly preserved due to the dry climate. The Sicarii, led by Eleazar, had managed to seize this fortress by treachery and considered themselves to be the last hope of the Jews to retaliate against Rome. Flavius Silva was named as the procurator of Judea. He decided to besiege this last stronghold of the Jews. A siege was mounted in autumn, AD 72, and lasted 7 months to the spring of 73. Between the time of the destruction of Jerusalem and the siege of Masada, Jews in many cities outside of Judea had been slaughtered by the population of those cities to demonstrate to the Romans that the inhabitants of all these cities despised the Jews who had proven they were enemies of Rome. And these actions further alienated the zealots at Masada. Flavius Silva decided to build a wall encompassing Masada to prevent anyone from escaping. He then began building ramps against the lowest part of the massive cliffs. At a point where the fortress wall was 450 feet high, he built a 350-foot-high ramp, upon which he built a pile of rocks 75 feet high, upon which he constructed an iron-plated tower of 90 feet. He set his war engines on this tower and began battering the wall. It soon fell. During this time, the zealots had constructed another wall framed from large timbers filled with dirt. And battering this wall only served to compact the earth with which it was filled. Realizing that he would be unable to destroy this wall by this means, the Roman general ordered it to be set on fire. At first, the wind brought the flames down upon the soldiers below, threatening to set their own engines on fire. But suddenly the wind changed and ignited the entire wall. The Romans retreated for the night, knowing they'd be able to capture the fortress the next day. Eleazar, realizing that all was lost, determined to persuade the zealots not to allow the Romans to take him alive. In his impassioned speech, he said, quote, "This is the effect of God's anger against us for our manifold sins, which we've been guilty of in a most insolent and extravagant manner with regard to our own country, the punishments of which let us not receive from the Romans, but from God himself, as executed by our own hands. For these will be more moderate than any other. Let our wives die before they are abused, and our children before they have tasted slavery. And after we have slain them, let us bestow that glorious benefit upon one another mutually and preserve ourselves in freedom as an excellent funeral monument for us. But first, let us destroy our money and our fortress by fire. For I'm well aware that this will be great grief to the Romans, that they shall not be able to seize upon our bodies and shall fail upon our wealth also. Let us spare nothing but our provisions, for there'll be a testimonial when we're dead that we were not subdued for want of necessity, but that according to our original resolution, we have preferred death before slavery." He further reminded them of the fate that had befallen many of their countrymen and the other cities around Jerusalem, following the fall of Jerusalem. So he said, "If you do leave here, there's nowhere that you can go. No one will receive you." Each of the men then proceeded to embrace his wife and children and execute them. Then they piled all their possessions in a heap and set them on fire. Casting lots, they chose 10 men to execute the remainder. Each man lay beside his wife and children and offered his neck to the executioner. Those 10 again cast lots to select one who would execute them and then kill himself. There were 960 men, women, and children who died in this suicide pact. There was, however, one older woman, a relative of Eleazar, who hid herself and 5 children in underground caverns to avoid being killed. They were the sole survivors of the families at Masada. The next morning, the Romans scaled the fortress, prepared to fight, but they were met with absolute silence. They shouted as if they were using a battering ram to see if anyone would come out. The 6 survivors emerged and reported the events that had transpired. The doubtful Romans quickly made their way to the palace buildings and where they viewed the grisly scene in amazement. When Masada was taken, the general left the garrison in the fortress to keep it, and he himself went.